Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians. The companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the CEOs, leaders, clinicians, politicians, thinkers that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners will know, I am a CEO and founder of a health tech venture myself, which is called PocDoc. PocDoc is revolutionizing the way that we deal with early detection and ongoing treatment of preventable diseases like cardiometabolic and renal diseases. We work extensively across the NHS. And if anyone is interested in our healthy heart check, which is the equivalent of an NHS health check, but done in 10 minutes using your phone, please head to the website pocdoc.co. And thank you as ever to PocDoc for supporting the show. Thank you also to everybody who's listening live on the wonderful UK Health Radio. We love Johan and his entire team for giving us this live platform. Thank you to everyone who is listening on any of the on-demand streams. So the podcast channels, Apple, Spotify, etc., YouTube, and Instagram. So over on a monthly basis now, we're getting over 300,000 streams across all platforms, which is amazing, and the numbers are going up. So whether you're listening on the Health Tech Hour channel, on the podcasts or YouTube, or whether you're following me on Instagram, which is at Steve Roost, thank you very much for all of that, for all of the support. We really appreciate it. We love all the comments, all the questions. Thank you so much for supporting the show. We wouldn't be here without you. Now, on to today's show. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I forgot to mention as well, like I always mention, every single show that is on UK Health Radio is also available on the UK Health Radio podcast channels on all of the podcast platforms. So go check that out. Now, the last couple of shows, we've dealt with this idea of an electronic health record, democratization, clarification, digitization of health data. And there's a little bit of an extension from those into today's topic of conversation, which is with Paul McGuinness, who's the CEO of Linus Healthcare. Linus Health. For those of you who don't know, I just found out that Linus is the Celtic goddess of health, which was a new one on me. And their focus is on intelligent disease management for chronic conditions. One of their tools in the armory is virtual wards. But this touches on AI, it touches on electronic health records, it touches on the increasing digitization of the healthcare service. And I think it's just a really interesting area, because this is something that for those of you that don't work in the healthcare system but have an interest, this is something that is becoming ever more funded, ever more integrated, ever more the kind of default approach to delivering these new models of care. So I'm excited to get into it. Paul, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great, Steve. Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Great. Is Linus the god or the goddess? Which one?
Linus is the Celtic god of healing, Steve.
God of
healthcare.
Healing.
Yeah, there's a few companies in Germany, I think, with the name as well. It's quite common over there.
Okay. Yeah, I'm guessing back in the day, they didn't really have healthcare. So like healing is probably what they had. Look, thanks a lot for coming on the show. What I think would be really helpful, because I know that your business and the way that you think about things covers kind of quite a lot of ground. It would be great if you could just for a few minutes give us your personal journey to where you've got to now and why you care so much and how that overlaps with what Linus is up to.
Yeah, sure. So my background is in kind of digital transformation. I uh, I founded a digital transformation consultancy called Storm ID about 20 years ago or so now. And I've kind of grown that up to around about 120 people, and it delivers kind of service delivery of transformation into a lot of the UK public sector, government, local government, and increasingly into healthcare as well. But at different points in the kind of tech cycle over the last kind of 20 years, we've experimented with kind of new technologies such as cloud, social, mobile, and we've sought to kind of incubate products inside the services business and have kind of spun them out successfully in a couple of different instances. And about 6-7 years ago, I started to look at the healthcare sector and kind of identified two kind of big trends at that point that I thought was going to have a profound impact on how care was delivered. I guess the first was the kind of increasing amount of health data being generated outside of the traditional hospital settings from devices, wearables, and more sophisticated connected medical devices. And the second was really around the kind of use of and the growing kind of use of machine learning and how that could be used to make sense of some of those data streams that we're collecting from patients, as well as the data held in the clinical record, and really how that could be used to provide actionable insight to clinical teams. So we saw the opportunity to kind of exploit those two tech trends and really apply them to the kind of challenge of chronic conditions. So our kind of thesis at Linus is very much focused on chronic conditions and how we can transform how we diagnose and manage key chronic conditions. Across the US and European and UK, there's about 30% of patients in the population that have a long-term condition, and they drive about 70% of the spend or the cost in the system through inpatient, outpatient activity, GP visits, prescribing, and so on. And I guess what we're seeing increasingly now is that care for chronic conditions is becoming increasingly dispersed across different care settings, from hospital into kind of primary and community care, and now increasingly in the home environment with the use of kind of remote patient monitoring, virtual wards, as you mentioned, and general kind of hospital at home plays. And we're also seeing care, a lot more dispersed between different medical specialties, which we think is a growing problem given the number of patients that are living with more than one condition. So patients are often going to see the cardiologist and then later to go and see the respiratory consultant. So I guess as a result, what we're seeing is, often really quite complicated and inefficient pathways. We're seeing a lot of fragmentation of data across different care settings, and ultimately, we're not seeing patients being diagnosed early enough. We've got about 8 million patients on the waiting list in the UK at the moment. Recent reports from people like Asthma and Lung UK are saying that, 1 in 4 people with COPD in the UK are waiting up to 5 years for their diagnosis. And so we've got big waiting times for diagnostics. And then when you are diagnosed, I think what we're seeing in the since kind of COVID is that the kind of chronic condition reviews in primary care, which were routinely happening up until that point. So stable patients get a review every year, more high risk patients every 6 months or so. I think we're seeing those reviews, the number of those reviews collapsing in the UK, and ultimately patients are not receiving guideline directed therapy, which in turn is kind of driving high rates of hospital admission across both, not just in the UK, but we're seeing it, I guess, in Europe and the US. So we're getting high rates of hospital admission because these patients' disease is decompensated. Their hospitals are, patching them up and then pushing them out again. But I guess in the UK, it's around 40% of patients with a condition like COPD, for example, are crash landing back into hospital within 90 days. So I guess generally where we see the demographic trends and so on, I think I saw a stat recently saying that the number of people in the UK with chronic conditions is set to rise by another 30% in the next 20 years or so. So we're really not set up to manage that kind of demand. And I guess our kind of central thesis is that, transformational models of care are required here. The challenge is great.
And so that was a great intro. Lots to unpack in there. Just to go right back to the beginning. So you set up your own business to focus on IT transformation, and it's now 120 people. That's pretty good growth.
Yeah, well, it took 20 years to get to that point. So, yeah, I mean, it was pretty good growth. And I think what it gave me is a foundation in not just around kind of delivering technology, but also around kind of service design and user research and building digital services to meet the needs of users, which I think is a really key requirement in healthcare.
And did you bootstrap it from the beginning, or what were the kind of origins of it?
Yeah, we bootstrapped it. I was one of kind of four co-founders in the beginning, we took a little bit of debt at the start, but paid it off quite early, and then kind of bootstrapped it all the way since then.
And plain sailing, or were there some because the contractions and stuff? Because we you weren't always you healthcare is relatively new, right? But you were always public sector focused.
Yeah, largely public sector folks. We did a little bit in financial services and logistics and so on. But maybe 60-70% of the business was public sector. And yeah, there's always the kind of peaks and troughs of public sector spending that can affect things. But generally over the last kind of 20 years or so, even when kind of spending reviews are spending is tighter, then there's more investment in digital to try and achieve cost savings.
Okay, cool. And why did you start that business? Like, what prompted you to do that? Like, what was the
Well, this
inspiration?
was 2001, I think it was about a month before September 11th we started the business, and at that point we're working in kind of ad agencies and so on, and the internet was the new thing, so why not? We threw a lot in and went for it.
Wow, big step. Okay, so let's try and kind of unpack some of the health stuff there. So, just for everyone listening, what is included in the phrase chronic condition?
So chronic conditions really are any kind of what we call long-term conditions that a patient can have over a number of years. So it can be things like cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, diabetes, kidney disease, and severe asthma. Those five kind of long-term conditions I've mentioned there are some of the big hitting ones in the UK.
Okay. And why none of this is unknown, right? None of this is new. And I mean, I say this kind of playing devil's advocate because we are also operating in the cardiometabolic and renal spaces. So it's like I know some of this stuff, but just for everyone listening, none of this stuff is new. So what is it that hasn't happened over the last decade or 2 decades or longer, do you think that's kind of created this situation that we find ourselves in at the moment?
Well, I think, on the demand side, I think I go back and look at reports from 2005 and so on, and that have been written in the UK, and they're very, very clear around the problem of chronic conditions at that point. And often they talk about our care system being set up to deal with kind of episodic interactions, so an
Yeah,
outpatient
acute.
appointment, secondary care, or a GP appointment. And our IT systems really reflect that model where it's very episodic and transactional. And I think with the growing kind of burden of chronic conditions, these patients have these conditions for 15, 20 years now, and the
Or
systems
longer,
that
or
or
longer.
longer,
Like,
yeah, or
did you see
longer.
the story, the data released by Diabetes UK last week, I think it was, where there's a huge increase in the number of people under the age of 40 being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. Those
Yeah,
guys might,
yeah.
people might have that for 30, 40 years, depending on how they manage it.
Absolutely. And I think, I guess the ability for these systems to support healthcare practitioners in managing that disease over that time period is kind of what we need. It's more akin to like a CRM for patients over that period rather than a GP system, which is managing your regular appointments.
And so is it your take on it? How is your sort of angle on this? Is it more from a clinical perspective or more from a technology backbone perspective or a bit of both? Or like where's your thesis in this whole
Well,
thing?
I mean, I think there's two kind of key technologies I think that are kind of areas of innovation that I think can really help break apart how chronic conditions are managed at the moment. I think the first is really around how we can empower patients to deliver more data into the care system to improve their care. So things like patient-generated health data, and that's whether that's from devices or patient-reported outcome data. And that gives you an opportunity to virtualize some of the interactions that are done currently either on face-to-face or telephone, and do it more in an asynchronous way. So I think patient-generated health data is a big one. And then secondly, around, I think, AI, a lot of how we manage chronic conditions at the moment is very high cost, very reactive. And for us, you know, the use of kind of machine learning models and predictive AI is really the kind of opportunity or the game changer to reorientate care provision and make it shift it left into more prevention and more proactive and give care teams better insights of the patients who are at risk.
Okay. And are you guys, I mean, of all those, the thing is each one of those diseases, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease, asthma and COPD. Was there another one that you mentioned?
Those no, that was ones. The. I think that's the five big
the
ones.
Five anyway, horsemen, yeah. The apocalypse.
Yeah.
The each one of those is enormous, yeah. Absolutely enormous, and so how do you think that these systems should be trying to tackle them? Is there a standard sort of technology platform that should be in place, or, you know, should people be doing different things for different disease conditions? I mean, then you multiply it up by you've got 42 ICSs or integrated care systems in the UK, plus I think 20 up in Scotland. You know,
yep.
it starts to become really, really complex.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and as I said, I've delivered kind of digital transformation pretty much on a lot of different sectors, and healthcare is without a doubt the hardest to do that. I mean, I guess our kind of thesis around this is that there's missing digital infrastructure really required for chronic disease that gives care teams both the kind of digital tools as well as the data insights to manage disease across the pathway. So I guess we see kind of three pillars of it. So the first is around what we call kind of diagnostics. And that, you know, we've developed kind of software that looks to how to automate the diagnostic workflows to try and streamline the kind of speed up steps, resolve bottlenecks and reduce the need for so many outpatient appointments associated with it. So we've deployed this, what we call kind of clinical workflow automation around the kind of diagnostic workflows and deployed them into a few community diagnostic centres, really to look at, so they enable kind of like a hub and spoke model, where more testing and clinical examination can happen in community settings closer to the patient. And, you know, the software allows the, you know, the decision making, if need be, to be escalated to secondary care specialists without the data having to move around. So that kind of diagnostic side, we've deployed that, and in a study we've shown we can reduce waiting times down from 12 months to 4 weeks. And we did that in a 3 month period for heart failure.
How does that work? I mean, that's such a drop.
Yeah.
And how does, like, how, I mean, I know that you don't want to give away your secret sauce probably on live radio, mm-hmm. but that's such a dramatic reduction, 12 months to 4 weeks.
Yeah, so, I mean, in that case, it's a cardiologist who's making the final decision on whether a patient has heart failure. So a couple of the things we did in that instance is that the cardiologist did not have to see the patient. So the cardiologist was given a work list of patients which had their echocardiogram, their ECG results, their clinical exam results, and a bunch of other information that had been collated as part of that journey. So we aggregated that in, we pulled in data from the labs. And so the cardiologist had a work list to look at, and they ran through that work list a lot quicker than they would have done otherwise. So the study showed that a cardiologist could see 20 or could outcome 25 patients in the same time as they could outcome 10. In the previous kind of clinic face-to-face.
Wait,
clinic
so,
model.
So the previous model would have been, or is, I guess, that they come in, then they look at all the results and everything, maybe if they've got them, perhaps, and then they make a decision about whether they want to sort of see them again.
That's correct. Yeah, so there's normally multiple outpatient appointments. So the initial appointments to get your test done, you might come back again if one of the tests is inconclusive. Then once the tests are complete, there'll be a follow-up outpatient appointment made maybe 4 to 6 weeks later with the cardiologist, depending on their diaries. You come up there, cardiologist would review the data. Sometimes the data wouldn't be there, so sometimes you'd have to do another appointment, so on and so forth. So it's really about how you can streamline those pathways and virtualize the outcome and also automate the communication and the treatment plan.
Okay.
So that's the kind of diagnostic side, yeah.
Yeah, and were those, you know, the echocardiogram and those things, were those diagnostics being done at home, or were they being done in a community center or in a cardiology clinic, or where were those being done?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So I guess the strategy for us around this kind of diagnostics play was really to allow that hub and spoke model where more testing, certainly at the moment, is done in community settings. But the way we've set it up is that we see the direction of travel for more of these tests to be done in the home setting. You know, I think COVID has shown that with the kind of COVID testing that people are capable of taking these tests, and we'll see a lot more innovation in that space over time. But what the health service needs is kind of software to allow that data to flow through to the decision makers, ultimately to then record what the outcome is for that patient and then communicate what the treatment plan is.
Okay, that makes sense to me. And so how do you think that can be applied to other sectors or other diseases, rather? Is a similar model possible?
Yeah, so I think the model is similar. So we have the kind of pathways live around kind of things like COPD for breathlessness, and we're working on one around severe asthma at the moment. So how patients can be diagnosed with severe asthma and put onto kind of new modern drugs like biologics and so on. But I think the reason we've gone to this kind of diagnostic space is not just because there's waiting times, but for us it was a key point in the pathway where we could collect very rich structured data on patients. And you better phenotype patients at that point to then support more kind of precision medicine techniques. So what we're doing is we're using the data collected at the diagnostic side with consent and permission and information governance approvals to then train models to risk stratify the population. So of the patients who are diagnosed, how likely are those patients to be admitted to hospital within the next 3 months, for example? How likely are they to die in the next 12 months? So that gives, you know, the care teams better insights of who's at risk and where to prioritize the kind of limited resources they've got.
Okay, well, we'll come back to this in the next sector and really dig into that, particularly how it overlaps with AI and machine learning. I think it'd be really interesting. So we'll be back after 2 minutes with a commercial break. Thank you very much. We'll be back in a minute.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, CEO of Octoc, and my guest this week, Paul McGuinness, the CEO of Linus Health. So let's get into how this whole, because there's a lot of people that focus on chronic conditions, and there's a lot of people that have technology that does different bits and bobs of it. So to speak, like to pick a particular area or pick a particular condition or pick a particular sort of thing. But why, if we look at this from the patient's perspective, like, why does this matter? And is this problem ever solvable in the UK? Or is there something that's sort of critically wrong with the NHS that means it's just never going to get much better? Like, what are your thoughts?
No, I'm pretty optimistic that that things can get a lot better for patients. I guess in relation to what patients want, I think if you look at kind of research into any the kind of big hitting chronic diseases, the patient's priority is to avoid going to a hospital, is to avoid having an emergency admission. And certainly in a lot of the diseases we're kind of focusing on in the kind of cardiorespiratory space, a lot of these admissions are avoidable.
What's your gut feel on what's avoidable percentage wise? Do you have any?
I mean, I think it's an interesting area. So I think our models, for example, can predict 3 out of every 4 hospital readmissions, for example. And we think if healthcare teams were given these insights saying, here are the patients who are at risk of crash landing into hospital, and you ally that with an intervention model, which is maybe be pharmacist-led from a primary care perspective, for example, we think we can stop around between 50 and 75% of those admissions coming in.
Which is amazing. I mean, if you can do that, of interventions?
Yeah, so I think the interventions are largely around them. If you take, again, COPD, for example, is making sure the patient's on the right medication. for their disease. I think medicines optimization is a huge part of preventing patients coming into hospital. But, you know, I guess there's also, you know, interventions like, you know, pulmonary rehab, smoking cessation. And ultimately, you know, we've seen through different digital tools as well is patients interacting with these tools that gives them a better understanding of their own symptoms and so on, so they can better self-manage over time. So, you know, I think there's large savings to be made. In our remote monitoring side of things, we've demonstrated around 50% admissions drop in two different studies now. So one in Glasgow and then a second one in Hull. So we're showing against a kind of control cohort that we can reduce admissions by about 50%. So I think the savings are there.
Which condition?
That was in COPD again. So that was in both in Hull and Glasgow.
Why? So I've spoken to COPD is not our space, not mm-hmm. my space. But it seems like a lot of the major conditions work is focused on that particular condition. It's quite high up the list, right? Is that because mm-hmm. is that because there's such a high risk of people being admitted to hospital if they have a flare up or an attack or whatever? That I'm not quite sure what the technical term is.
Yeah, so it's an exacerbation. Yes. Yeah, so the COPD is the second most common cause of emergency admission in the UK, so it's very high up on the list. And as I said, you know, the view from the research and so on is that a large percentage of those admissions are preventable. And really, the issue is around how you can identify the rising risk in patients over time right. and intervene earlier. And
that's right, those triggers, basically, right?
Yeah, if you can identify patients whose risk is rising and you can intervene earlier, then you stop that exacerbation. As I said earlier, I think once the patient gets into hospital, their chance of then being readmitted in 90 days is around, I think, 43% at the moment, which is really high.
Wow. And is that because they're being discharged without a good platform to assure to prevent them coming back? Or is there something about the hospital stay?
No, I think, well, the fact that you have an exacerbation in the first place makes it more likely that you'll have a second one. So it's a deteriorating illness over time. So the priority is to, you know, is to prevent the exacerbation to start with. Clearly, there's, you know, care bundles and packages that can influence that readmission percentage figure. But fundamentally, once you have an exacerbation that lands you in hospital, you're more likely to have another.
And of those kind of triggers and those warning signs, how many different markers or variables are there that you would want to track or should be tracking or could be tracking?
Yeah, so we've just completed a study which was funded by the NHSX AI Awards, where we put three different machine learning models into kind of clinical workflow. And those models predicted the patient's likelihood of admission to hospital in the next 90 days, readmission to hospital in the next 90 days, and their chance of mortality, i.e. how likely they are to be alive or dead. You know, the purpose was to look at how these risk scores in the hands of clinicians, how they might affect the trajectory of these patients by, you know, being very much very targeted about the identifying the patients at high risk and then, as we say, intervening earlier. So, you know, the interim results of that trial are very promising. As I said, we can predict three out of every four. But, the insights are only as valuable as the people who then act on them.
Yeah, so, I was going to say, like, that must be the frustration. I wonder whether that's where the rub is a little bit, where, you know, how it's, you know, and we've had to work on this quite a bit at PocDoc with the NHS partners that we have, which is the sort of so what of the whole thing, which is like, yeah, that's great. You can predict this stuff could happen.
Yeah.
What am I supposed to do with it? I'm running around an emergency department and I don't know what to do. And I've got millions and millions of people to deal with and huge backlogs. And yeah, okay, fine. But how do I actually deal with that data? Is that something that you've had to handle?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we're very much looking at how, you know, we're just completing our kind of class two certification with these models at the moment. And with a view to how we can use these models in advance of winter this year and do it at a more population-wide scale. And as you pointed out, I think the key here is how you align the insights from the models themselves with an intervention or a service model to actually identify the high risk and act on them. So the kind of service model we've come up with there is very much looking at how the insights from the model can be reviewed initially in a kind of secondary care environment, and then
Like a hospital, that's what
a
that means,
hospital,
right?
yeah, in a
Yeah.
hospital, sorry, yes, and then they would triage the original list and then provide kind of work lists down to kind of primary care for the patients that should be optimized, and they will take the more severe patients who wherever they can only prescribe certain therapies and so on.
So do you think that that particular, because that primary care, so GPs basically, for everyone, just get the jargon out of it, the GP system and the hospital system talking together and working together is a big challenge, isn't it? That's
Huge
a big
challenge, yeah.
frontier.
Yeah, the care coordination across the care settings of primary care and secondary care is a huge challenge. And listen, I think GPs are themselves underwater at the moment. They've got a lot of kind of acute and frailty they have to deal with, and they're dwindling in numbers, whereas the demand is only increasing. So GPs have the interaction with these patients, but ultimately it's the hospitals that have the problem because they're landing into ED at the moment. So I think one of the potential solutions we can consider is kind of pharmacists. So there's a lot of kind of pharmacists now being made available within primary care practices. So
And Pharmacy First,
and pharmacy
which
first,
is going quite
exactly.
well.
Yeah, exactly. And where if these individuals are given the insights, can they run some of the interventions on behalf of the GP and behalf of the kind of respiratory consultants and secondary care?
Do you feel like that's do you feel like that's viable?
Yes, I think so. I think, but it requires collaboration and working together in order to do it. We have there is this kind of study ongoing in Glasgow at the moment around this, and there'll be some results published later this year at various conferences. So I think the interim results have been very positive, but it requires good collaboration between the hospitals and the GP practices.
Yeah, I mean, I think if that's possible, then that will be groundbreaking, really groundbreaking. If it's possible to scale that up, because I think that that could be applied to a huge amount. Like even in our area, you've got cardiology clinics where people are showing up without up-to-date lipid test results, so they don't know, they get punted back to the GP, back into the phlebotomy system and the delays and so on and so forth. And it's probably less of an issue at emergency departments and things like that, but I think that that particular model, if you can crack it, could be really, really applicable in other areas.
And I think we've seen some good examples of that. So thinking in heart, in recently diagnosed patients with heart failure, you're seeing an increasing role of pharmacists playing there to titrate the patient on the appropriate mix of drugs. And
Is that right?
so I think that they're taking
That's
more of
cool.
a role there and trying to speed up getting the patient optimized on the correct mix of medicines.
Okay. And are they working out of a pharmacy, or are they working out of a sort of a primary care GP surgery? Probably, right?
Yeah, I think it's the latter generally, although we are seeing some of that in a secondary care environment as well. So I think it depends on the hospital system, I think.
Okay, so let's switch it up now and talk about AI and machine learning. So obviously, crazy hot area, only going to get hotter. Where's your thesis on this whole thing? Where do you come at this from?
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't think it's any accident that the most traction in healthcare system around AI has been in imaging so far. So detecting kind of different cancers and so on from a CT scan or an X-ray, and the reason that's been is the data input is fairly standardized. It's either, as I said, a CT scan or an X-ray or some kind of other image generated. So. And listen, there's a huge amount of opportunity to automate and drive kind of efficiency through that process. And we've seen some great kind of studies around that. But I guess my broader kind of thesis is the AI needs really good quality data. And I think where predictive AI, which is more about how predicting future events in patient has got the bigger opportunity to kind of really transform care provision, particularly around chronic conditions. But that AI needs really good quality data collected. And so I think a prerequisite for getting that AI working is better digital tools to, you know, to diagnose patients and then manage the population. And then we'll start to see some of the...
Do you feel like this is going to kind of end up... Because do you feel like this is going to kind of go through a phase like where the internet sort of started back when it was telcos and walled gardens and everyone has their own data sets and... You know, my AI model is better than your AI model, which is a little bit where we are in imaging at the moment.
Mm.
There's a lot of businesses that are focused on different slices of that imaging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my model works for melanoma. My model works for prostate. I know the hospitals are opening up those imaging data sets, mm-hmm. but I don't know if it's as easy to open up data sets on chronic conditions because what is that data? Where is that data? Where, you know, am I
yeah.
wrong?
No, there's some really good data sets, and we talk a lot about the UK's kind of health data asset, and there is some really great data sets around kind of labs and prescribing and patient event data that are all kind of are well collated, and there's been steps to make them available through the kind of secure data environments. And I think in time, you know, the work around the federated data platform may mm-hmm. offer a route to operationalizing more of these types of models in clinical practice. But I guess my longer term view of it is that the AI in terms of predictive AI will get better when there's better digital tools to manage the chronic disease, because at the moment it's very difficult, I think, to deploy AI into the current infrastructure that's there. You know, and the electronic health record system, a GP system, they're not necessarily seen as medical devices, for example, at the moment. I think they have an exemption. So okay. How you deploy AI safely onto those tools is an open question at the moment.
Right. So the patient record, I love talking about this stuff. So the patient record itself is not a medical device.
No. They have an exemption. Yeah.
And that exemption is based on what argumentation? Like...
I'm not really up on the idea. We've been looking at how we partner with different kind of EPRs, for example, around how we might bring our models to their data. Mm-hmm. And I think some of them are certainly more advanced than others on it, but certainly some of the ones we've spoken to are very concerned about whether deploying, you know, AI in the form that we're talking about here will push them into a bracket that they're not comfortable with from a compliance point of view.
Okay, because if you deploy or someone deploys some model on their data, their electronic patient record, and determines some diagnosis or prediction or outcome, mm-hmm. someone might argue that entire process constitutes some form of medical device.
Correct, yes. Yeah. And that comes with its own kind of post-market surveillance and a whole bunch of other...
You shouldn't go into medical device regulation lightly by any stretch of the imagination. I think it's kind of interesting, though, that I'd never really thought about it, that, like, is it that those EPR companies, I mean, even people like EMIS and System One and stuff, they've just never set themselves up for that type of regulatory oversight. And so...
I think it's an interesting one that the kind of medical device regulation space in the UK and even more broadly than that is very difficult to navigate. I think with the introduction of AI, and I know the MHRA have made some steps in the direction here, the introduction of AI has really made the system even more complicated in terms of what conditions can you deploy machine learning models and how often can you update those models and so on. So
have they written stuff like that? They've written it into the regulations, have they? Like up
MHRA have released some principles around this area, and I think they are definitely making some good steps in the right direction, but you know, their priority is patient safety. And listen, you know, deploying AI into healthcare, it's you've got to do it safely, and it's got to be fair as well, and not introduce kind of bias into the system. So a lot about how we've gone about it is to try and make sure you're not just showing a risk score to patients,
Right.
you're also trying to present what we call explainability or interpretability that allows clinicians to look at the risk score and understand the clinical characteristics that are driving the risk score higher or driving the risk score lower. So the clinicians can interrogate it a little bit and ensure it's bioplausible and have some more trust in the score themselves to act on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that goes across anything, which is like if you present some kind of a risk score, you want people to understand intuitively
Absolutely,
whether it's whether I mean, definitely if it's you're providing it to a clinician for a clinician to make a decision on that data, that's really critical. But even at the patient level, like you presenting someone with bad news but no solution is rarely going to end particularly well, I don't think.
Yeah, certainly our research with patients has certainly around the risk scores we are presenting there. They're very happy for their care team and the clinicians to see them, but they themselves have not shown a lot of appetite for looking at their own risk scores, particularly around, the risk of admission and certainly obviously mortality.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, we've definitely dealt with some individuals on the really upper end of some of these conditions, and they were sort of yeah. There was an element where they didn't they're not they knew that they weren't in a good, healthy place, and so they didn't necessarily want to interact with their information too on too much of a detailed level. But what they did want was signposting guidance: what can be done, what can I do, that type of thing. No, I would agree with that. Right. We're going to go for our final commercial break. This is the final part of, we'll go into the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with my guest, Paul McGuinness, who is the CEO of Linus Health. We'll be right back after this final break.
The station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, CEO of PocTalk, and my guest this week, Paul McGuinness, who's the CEO of Linus Health. So heading into the final part of the show. So I want to kind of focus now a little bit on if you're somebody, if you're a patient that has one of these chronic conditions, or if someone in your family has one of these chronic conditions, or a friend, is there realistically anything that patients can actually do at this point to engage with programs or systems or things like that you've just been discussing? Or is it really very much if they just happen to live somewhere where someone's doing something like this, then they might be invited to join it? Or is there any practical things that anybody listening could actually do?
Yeah, I mean, I think care delivery is still, very much driven from the health system point of view, and how you can be opted into to some of these kind of programs to support either kind of self-management or co-management is really up to the health system. But I guess where I see the future of this, I heard an analogy a podcast quite a few years ago, and it kind of struck me as really quite relevant here. I think if you've had a car around kind of 20 years ago, and you took your car to the garage with a problem, and the mechanic would generally kind of open the bonnet, have a look around, and say, "Leave it with me for a few days, and I'll try and work out what the solution is." And nowadays, if you take a car to a mechanic, they'll just plug into the diagnostic side of it, and they'll use the data to instantly kind of diagnose what's wrong. And so I guess where I'm going with that is I guess over time, if you collect more data about yourself and about your kind of physiology and you can manage your systems and record your symptoms over time, hopefully over time the health system can start to use that data to more proactively give you care. That's kind of the longer term. I guess in the short term, I guess how you can use self-management and co-management apps to monitor your systems is kind of maybe the first step.
Okay. And are there any particular, like, and is it just to keep an eye on your symptoms so that you learn more about your own body, your own indicators, your own condition?
Yeah, I mean, I think people often ask me. So, as I said earlier, we ran two clinical studies around kind of remotely managing kind of COPD patients who are in the kind of top 20% of risk, and And people keep asking me, well, what is the secret sauce? Why have you managed to reduce admissions by 50% in this patient cohort? And it's often very difficult to answer. And when we go and ask patients, because I think a lot of the effectiveness of these tools is really around how patients sustain their engagement in the tools over a longer period of time.
Right.
And often we ask patients, well, why have you, you know, why do you use this app 4 times a week over the last 12 months? We can tell that's, you know, what we've done on average. And they say, well, if I can provide data about myself to my care team and they will use that data to you know, to deliver better care for me, I will continue to do that. And what I think that kind of co-management model where patients are contributing information, that information is then being used and they understand it's going to be used to deliver or make decisions on their healthcare, I think that's a kind of model for the future. And we hear a lot of kind of anecdotally that patients saying recording my symptoms on a daily or weekly basis does help me understand my condition better and understand where the, you know, the trigger points might be.
And how much of that do you think, how much of these conditions, and it might be different from the different conditions, but how much can be done through patient-generated self-entered data, which is arguably, if you've got engaged patients, easier to collect potentially than more hardcore clinical diagnostic evaluations that may require a physical visit to a physical location or a bit of equipment? What's your view on that?
Yeah, I think, we started initially in the kind of remote management space and kind of virtual ward space and collecting a lot of patient-generated health data. But certainly the feedback we had from clinicians was they would like to see this data allied and, you know, alongside the kind of clinical history data they get for that patient, alongside their labs data, their prescribing data, alongside, you know, their events data and so on. So I think, you know, I think it's very valuable data the patients can contribute, but it needs to be part of a wider kind of record of data. And so that's kind of led us to look at how can we kind of digitize the whole pathway for chronic condition patients. So we can introduce this data and have it alongside some of the clinical history data.
Yeah, I think it definitely has to be alongside. Have you come across BP at home, blood pressure at home?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing I love about that is that, and it was obviously driven by COVID, but, you know, they have, I was at a cardiovascular disease clinical prevention conference, NHS thing, and they were presenting some of the results from that. And just on a kind of sheer volume basis, that system gets about 3 million individual patient readings per year. So either through the phone or texted even in.
Yep.
Or potentially through a website, but mostly those two things. And it seems to be going very well. And everyone seems to be okay with it for the most part. That's highly highly rational.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me the kind of missing part or the next step for that model is using algorithms to look at those readings and detect anomalies and escalate then by exception. Because if we're still relying on someone in primary care to review those readings on a regular basis, then it's still kind of, we are kind of digitizing the kind of offline process. And I think there's another step to go, I think.
Well, I also think it ties into what you said earlier, which is, you know, the data that you collect is really only as good as the either the system or the process or the people that you have to look at that data, because it's about what you do with that data. That actually matters, because otherwise you're just throwing numbers into a overclocked system. And, you know, to your point, like, well, yeah, we can overlay the patient data with the clinical data, with the lab data, with this. But if there's not somebody or something that's able to interpret that data correctly, then, you know, I don't know, it's not going to help a huge amount, I don't think.
No. And then if you ask any clinician, you know, they're not wanting a fire hose of data in their face every day to, you know, to monitor. I think they get enough. So I think, you know, the role of algorithms and AI to interpret those data streams and identify the higher risk and escalate to care teams to act on it is for me a really key piece that we need to work on. But that requires good structured data.
Yeah, and it requires a huge amount of coordinated willpower and effort across a system. But that's why the systems were set up, you know, integrated care systems, kind of in the name. That's kind of, I think, part of the ethos of them, is to solve these problems that cross over the different sections within the system. But yeah, that's part of the reason for it. I think that's, it's a big challenge.
Yeah. And I think we need to, you know, we need to be a bit mindful that we don't just digitize the offline model. And I think, you know, I think on virtual wards, for example, I think it's great that we're seeing a lot of investment in, into these kind of digital tools to keep patients out of hospital, whether that's the kind of step down kind of model from the early supportive discharge or stepping up from primary care for those at risk. But I would, you know, be cautioned against it being the kind of silver bullet here, because you know, a lot of the kind of criticism of virtual wards is that they are, you know, identifying patients are very slow, and you know, you're obviously, you know, ultimately still a very reactive model of care where you're trying to onboard following the emergency admission, and so certainly a lot of the data is kind of siloed. So, you know, I kind of see it as very similar to you know, Yahoo and search engines, where it was the first thing out the gate, and you know, it was very popular, and essentially digitizing the kind of offline directory model at that point. Yeah. And I do think, you know, we need to consider more transformational models of care. So around how, you know, how we can manage these patients, and how we can use data and derive better insights from it.
I completely agree. What would one of those transformational models be? Because I think it's a great analogy, the comparison with Yahoo versus Google.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think if you look at, you know, let's say take a patient with a chronic disease at the moment, you know, the NICE guidelines will say that this patient should have one full review every year. And if they are, you know, above a certain risk threshold, i.e. they've had an admission recently, they should have two reviews per year. My view is that, you know, I guess once a patient has a diagnosis, we should be engaging with them digitally from there on in. And we should be doing much more regular digital reviews with the patient by asking them to submit information on their health, whether that's patient reported outcome data, test result data, and so on. And then using that data to then drive manual reviews or medicine optimization reviews based on need, rather than just on a standard kind of schedule of every 6 months or every 12 months. So that's a bit more of a radical way of looking at chronic conditions, where we've got limited resources here, rising demand. How can we use digital to actually change how we do care, rather than just digitizing the previous model?
That makes sense to me. Now, we've only got a few more minutes left in the show. And so I think it would be great if you could just kind of share some of the lessons, just more broadly, from having been in the entrepreneurial business for 20 years, dealing with, I would imagine, some fairly difficult, big clients in the public sector space, clearly trying to solve some major, you know, some major hurdles or some major challenges. So, you know, if anyone's listening, like, that wants to set up their own company or is doing it, like, what kind of things have you, the lessons that you've, that you would kind of point to, do you think, from the last 20 years?
I think it was Winston Churchill that says that success is moving from one failure to the next without any loss of enthusiasm. So I think, you know, I think certainly persistence is a really kind of key attribute to have. You're not always, you know, always going to win, and you know, you should embrace kind of failure. It's part of the process and part of the learning. And I think more specifically around kind of digital and digital transformation, I think, you know, we need to move away from IT programs and start building services which are enabled by digital technology. You know, 85 to 90% of people in the UK have a smartphone. You know, there's more people in the world that have a smartphone than have running water. So we should be targeting these types of tools and looking at how we can deliver public services. And, you know, finally, I think, you know, the AI side of things is I think even with the new kind of LLMs and generative AI models, I think it'll open up the opportunity to automate a lot more of these public service, citizen facing public service transactions. So, you know, I would learn about that and learn about how AI can be embedded into services.
Cool. Well, look, on that note, Paul, thank you very much for coming on the show. Much appreciated. And thank you to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week with another show. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
I got my head out this sunroof. I'm blasting.